defining different notions of energy and making sure that we know what they all mean. So what I'd like to go through here is I'm going to stick again to Schwarzschild spacetime, and I want to work out two examples of redshift formulae that really illustrate the methods I was introducing this morning. So let's do that. So this is going to be redshift formula number one. So we're in Schwarzschild spacetime. So again, the metric is going to be given by the usual expression that I wrote down before. So this is the metric, and F is the usual 1 minus 2m over r, and the event horizon, of course, is at r equals 2m. And in the first situation, what I want to have a look at is what I'm going to describe in this space-time diagram, where I'm going to display t as a function of r. I'm going to cut off the interior, so this is the interior of the black hole I don't care about. The boundary is r equals 2m. And what I want to look at is a photon that would be emitted by an emitter close to the event horizon, or somewhere deep inside the Schwarzschild spacetime. The photon would propagate out and would be received by a receiver that I'll take to be at infinity. So that's really a standard redshift situation. We have the emitter right here at r equals some selected value r naught. We have a receiver. I'm thinking of the receiver as being at infinity, but I'll just draw it here. And I'm going to let the emitter send out a photon that's going to be propagating outwards with the speed of light. And what I want to do is to compare the energy that the receiver would receive compared with the energy that would actually be emitted. And when I talk about energies here, I'm talking about energy as measured by the emitter, or energy as being measured by the receiver. And there'll be a third energy in the problem, which would be the conserved energy of the photon associated with that Killing symmetry of the spacetime. So three energy quantities, we have to be clear at distinguishing them. So this is a photon. So I just want to work it all out, and then I'll consider a slightly more involved problem where the receiver is actually falling in toward the black hole, where the emitter is falling in toward the black hole. Okay, so I need to do two things. I need to specify the motion of the emitter and the receiver, but that's very simple. They're at rest in the space-time, so they only move in the time-like direction, in the time direction. The hard thing to do here, it's not hard, but it's the hardest piece of the problem, is to figure out the motion of the photon, and want to just do all three pieces of the problem, then we'll put it all together. So the emitter moves at constant radius, so nothing moves, so the emitter is at r equals r naught. Theta and phi are constant here, so no motion anywhere. The forward velocity of the emitter can only have a time component, which I'll write as t dot, the dot denoting proper time, differentiation with respect to proper time as measured at the position of the emitter. So there's only a t dot that I'll call t dot e, and all the other components of the forward velocity have to be zero because there's no motion in the spatial directions. I can figure out what t dot is by making sure that the forward velocity is normalized. So one condition I should impose, is the normalization condition on the velocity, on the emitter's velocity vector, which in this case only picks up the double summation here, only picks up a time component. So I get gtt t dot e squared. And GTT is given by minus F at the position of the emitter. So I'll just indicate this as that. And we have the T dot squared. And that's an equation I can solve for T dot, which means that for the emitter, T dot is equal to 1 over the square root of the metric function, which explicitly is given by 2m over r naught under the square root. And now we have the velocity of the emitter all figured out. For the receiver, well, it's the same story, except that now we're working at infinity, which means that t dot in that case is going to be equal to 1. So for the receiver, we're working at r equals infinity, so we're also talking about an observer at rest. So I can just, you know, take the limit where r naught goes to infinity, and I get my result. So in this case, the four velocity of the receiver is just 1, 0, 0, 0. And that, working at infinity, well, gives us a normalized velocity vector. The photon. The photon, I'm going to assume, is moving outward, but only in the radial direction. I'm going to assume that it's not, you know, going around, that there's no angular momentum in the motion of the photon, just to simplify things. So what I'm going to assume here is that the motion of the photon is such that theta dot and phi dot are both zero, which means that the tangent vector to the photon geodesic is going to have, you know, components along t and components along r, but that's it. And I'll denote the tangent vector. I'm going to denote k. That's my favorite notation for a vector that would be a null vector that would be tangent to a null geodesic. So I'll just denote it as such. And this will have a t dot and an r dot component, but no theta and phi component. The dot notation here, I should be careful. I should distinguish it from the previous dot notation. Over there, I was using proper time. Here, I'm going to use some other affine parameter on the motion of the photon. So I'll just denote the derivative with respect to, with a prime instead of a dot. That should keep the notation straight. Okay. So I need to say something about these things. So what I need to do is to try to use the Killing symmetry here as a way of, determining what these things are. You know, a way of doing that would be to substitute this into the geodesic equation for the photon trajectory. That would be one way of doing it. But that would require solving a second order differential equation. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I can save myself some trouble if I use the Killing symmetry, try to identify the constants of the motion on the photon trajectory, and use that in order to simplify the description. So that's my strategy here. So everything that I said previously about constants of the motion, I was, you know, thinking in the context of time-like word lines this morning, but there's nothing that tells me, you know, there was nothing about the treatment was not restricted to time-like motion. It applies just as well to light-like motion. So all the results that I derived did not use the fact that the tangent vector had to be a time-like vector. It could be a null vector. Everything follows through. And what we have for the photon is a conserved quantity, which, as usual, is going to be given by the contraction between the tangent vector and the time-like Killing vector of the Schwarzschild geometry. There would be another constant of the motion associated with the rotational Killing vector, but I've already set that equal to zero by making this choice here. So that's the only non-trivial conserved quantity that we have at our disposal. This has a component only in the time-like direction, so this is really what this is, minus kt. I used a metric to lower the index, so that is actually GTT KT. And KT is what I call K prime, and GTT is minus F. So the point of this calculation is that now I have a way of expressing T prime, one of my unknowns, in terms of a constant of the motion. And that's what I'm going to do. So from that equation, we have an expression for T prime in terms of some quantity E, which is an energy parameter. But now energy is that third notion of energy that I talked about. It's the conserved energy on the photon word line, something which a priori has nothing to do with the, you know, measured energies that we're trying to determine also in this problem. But we're going to use it as a tool to achieve that. So we have T prime, R prime I'm going to get by making sure that this is really a null vector. So I'm going to use something which would be analogous to the normalization condition I use up here, except that now instead of normalizing the vector, I'm going to make sure that it has a zero squared norm. So to complete this, what I need to tell you is that, well, the vector has to be a null vector. We have a double sum, but now we have components along T and R, so I have to account for all of them. So along the T, you know, if I evaluate the double sum, I start with the TT component of the metric, that's minus F, multiplying T prime, multiplying T prime. And then we have the radial component in the sum, GRR is F minus 1, and here we have R prime all squared. All of that has to be 0. I know what T prime is. T prime is what I worked out over here, so this is minus, so this would be E squared over F squared with an F, so we get minus F E squared plus 1 over F R prime squared. I can cancel out the f's, and I have the condition that r prime squared has to be equal to e squared. And if I want a photon that goes out, I have to pick the positive sign when I take the square root. So I'll write the answer over here. R prime, in this case, is equal to plus e. So now I have the tangent vector to the photon word line all figured out. And now we can put all the pieces together. So the first question I'll ask is, what is the energy of the photon as measured by the emitter? So let me say that in full so that we're clear on the terms. Energy, photon's energy, as measured by the emitter. So that would be the proper energy of the photon as, you know, released by the apparatus that, you know, the laser thingy that the emitter would hold. So the photon's energy as measured by the emitter, that's what I'll call E with a sub E. That's a physically meaningful notion of energy measured by somebody. And according to the results we discussed before, that's the contraction between the momentum of the photon, the momentum of the particle, here the particle is a photon, the momentum of the photon is represented by this null vector k, and the observer's velocity, and here we're talking about the emitter. Here you might be worried about scale. Is this really the momentum vector of the photon? I haven't told you anything about the scale of the fine parameterization. There's always a scale ambiguity underlying the discussion of null particles. I'm not going to try to resolve it. What I'm going to be talking about is a ratio of energies. I want a redshift formula, so it's going to be a ratio of energies. So whatever ambiguity of scale that I have here will be gone when I take the ratio. So let's not worry about the scale. Another way to say this is that I could make sure by choosing the affine parameter correctly, the scale of the affine parameter correctly, I could be sure that physically speaking, this is really the momentum vector of a photon. But I don't really need to worry about those details. Okay, but I'll call that the energy, and I'll just assume that it's energy measured in some, you know, undefined scale of energy. And okay, well, that is what we proposed this morning as a meaningful notion of energy. It's a scalar quantity that does correspond to the energy that would actually be measured physically, and all we need to do now is to work it out. So this is just the inner product of two vectors, so I can write it in a way that makes the metric obvious. This has a T and R component, this only has a T component, so the only term that I pick up in the double sum is going to be the TT term. So we get minus GTT, which is, so we get a minus GTT, which is F. we get T prime, which has been worked out to be E over F. And we got the T component of the observer's velocity, which is 1 over F. So I should be more careful. So here I'm evaluating everything at the position of the emitter, right? So the F I'm talking about here is the function F evaluated at R naught. This is the component of the the momentum of the photon evaluated at the position of the emitter, and the missing piece is 1 over the square root of F that comes from the time component of the velocity vector. And what do we get? We get that those Fs cancel out, and the physically measured energy at the position of the emitter is the energy parameter of the photon divided by square root of F. All right? Okay, we need another piece to this calculation. We need the photon's energy. As measured at infinity by the receiver. And we go through exactly the same calculation, but it's like taking the R goes to infinity limit of that result. So if we go through exactly the same steps, we do everything the same, except that now the F will refer to infinity, this F will refer to infinity, that F will refer to infinity, they're all one. And the answer we get here for ER, which is defined to be this quantity, is E. So what's that E? Well, the way we set it up this morning, that E is the measure of the energy of the photon as measured at infinity. And if I agree that E will be, so if we agree that this E is going to be the received energy, the measure, the energy that would actually be measured by somebody receiving the photon at infinity, then we've also resolved the scale ambiguity. So we've made the scale of the affine parameter such that what we measure in the end is the actual physical energy of the photon. So here we sort of resolve all the sort of little ambiguities and we assign a meaning to that quantity. That E is conserved, so as the photon propagates outward from where it originates to where it's going to be received, that E doesn't change. But that E is only physically an energy when you measure the photon at infinity. When you measure the photon deep in, well, the actual energy is not E, it's that combination here. And now we have a Rich's formula. So if I calculate the ratio of the received energy to the emitted energy, well, I get the square root of F, which is the square root of 1 minus 2m over R naught. And that's, you know, one of the standard redshift formulas that you probably have seen before, probably derived differently, but here, you know, derived using, I think, pretty elegant methods that are guaranteed to succeed because, you know, you've done the thinking very clearly every step of the way. And, you know, calculations like that in GR are typically not that difficult mathematically, but it's to make sure that you understand what you're doing along the way and you're not confusing yourself because here we have three notions of energy. You have to be clear on what is what, and that's where you have to do the thinking. The math typically is really not a problem. So any mysterious steps here? Okay, let's do one that's a little bit more, you know, involved and a little bit more interesting. So, yeah, I'll start over here. So, redshift number 2. So let's consider a different situation. Still in Schwarzschild, this is the same space-time diagram. We still have the boundary of the black hole right here. But now I'm going to do a twist, and instead of having a static emitter, I'm going to let the emitter fall in toward the black hole. So the emitter goes like this. Falls right in, and I'm going to tell you exactly how it's doing that. Because I have to specify the motion of the emitter before I can state the problem. So we have the emitter, the receiver is still going to be safely at infinity, and it's still going to be static observer, so we're not going to change the picture here. And the emitter is still going to emit a photon that's going to go outward with the speed of light. And we want to compare the energies measured here and here. So the only thing that I've changed here is the motion of the emitter. The photon description is exactly the same. The receiver description is exactly the same, but now I have to tell you more about the emitter and you know, work out this piece of the problem. So in this case, the emitter, I'm going to say, is going to also fall in radially, so I'm forgetting about angular momentum in this case too, just to keep things simple. So it's going to be an emitter that falls in radially, and I'm going to assume, also for simplicity, that it started out from infinity with no velocity. So you just release it very gently from infinity, it falls in, and as it falls in, it starts to move faster and faster. So the emitter is falling in radially, starting from rest, at infinity. And part of the problem is to turn this statement into mathematics, right? And we're going to use the constants of the motion and all of those tools at our disposal. All right. So let's think about it. So we have the four velocity of the emitter, which you know, having restricted the motion to be purely in time and the radial direction, there will be a t dot, there will be an r dot, and there will be zero components along the angular directions. By the way, something I didn't mention before, but I should have. This observer is not geodesic. Right, this observer has to maintain himself or herself at constant constant radius in the Schwarzschild spacetime. The black hole is pulling it it's pulling it in, so it has to it has to find a way to maintain itself there, maybe by using a a portable rocket engine or something like that. But one way or another, even though this observer is not moving in the spatial directions, there is acceleration. This is an accelerated observer. This is not motion along a geodesic. This is going to be a free-falling observer. That observer falling in follows a geodesic, and the acceleration associated with that, the relativistic acceleration associated with that velocity vector is zero. Okay. It's important because it's only if the motion is geodesic that I can relate t dot to a constant of the motion. If the motion is not geodesic, I don't have that result. I don't have a constant of the motion. The constant of the motion only is obtained if the motion is geodesic. So that's an important point. But having the constant of the motion, so having geodesic motion and having the time-like symmetry of the Schwarzschild spacetime, I have a conserved quantity, which I'll call E. Well, here I should be careful because I'm introducing a different E from what I've used for the photons. So let's call that something else. I'll call it epsilon. Instead of E. Epsilon is going to be defined in the usual way in terms of the four velocity of the observer, in this case the emitter, and the time-like killing vector of the Schwarzschild spacetime. And here, in fact, it's not energy, it's energy per unit mass, because here I'm using the velocity vector, not the momentum vector. I'll often not distinguish between what is energy and what is energy per unit mass. That's my problem. I apologize. Okay, and if we work it out, which we did before, this is t dot times f, which means that relying on the constant of motion, we have an expression for T dot in terms of epsilon divided by F. And that looks a lot like what we had for the photon. It's not accidental. You know, the expressions follow for exactly the same reason. Okay, we have T dot. We're going to figure out what R dot needs to be by imposing the normalization condition. And then I'm going to connect with that statement right here that we're demanding that this observer falls in from infinity. So let's see, I have the photon description right here. I don't want to spoil that, so I'll just use this board. over here. Okay, so to discover what R dot needs to be, I'm going to use the normalization condition. Which is this. And we're going to get two terms here. In the double sum, we start out with the TT terms. And GTT is minus F, and we get T dot squared. And the RR terms are going to be F minus 1 R dot squared. And that's all we have because we don't have motion in the angular directions. So we got that. We already have a substitution for T dot, so I'll use that. And for the first term, we're going to end up with epsilon squared divided by F plus R dot squared divided by F. So that's an equation I can solve for R dot. And I think the answer is that R dot squared plus F is going to be equal to epsilon squared. Let's see if I did that right. So I multiply through by F. I have R dot plus F equals F. Yeah, so that's the correct expression for R dot squared. And by the way, that's the sort of equation we always encounter in mechanics, right? We have kinetic energy plus potential energy equals conserved energy. So that's something that can be analyzed through energy diagrams. I won't take the time to do that, but you know, all of those tools are, you know, usable and portable in this context as well. Okay, if I want to continue the problem, I'm interested in an observer that's moving in, so I'm going to solve for R dot, and I'm going to take the negative sign when I take the square root. So the solution is that R is going to be minus the square root of E squared minus F, and F is 1 minus 2m over R. So that's the solution for R dot. And I can use the fact that I want my observer to start from rest at infinity to actually determine the constant of motion. So I've imposed a boundary condition, an initial condition on the four velocity, which is to say that when R is infinity, R dot should be zero. That's what it means to start from rest at infinity. If I want to arrange that, if R goes to infinity, if I want R dot to be infinity, to be zero, I need to get rid of that, which means that the initial condition is such that E, or epsilon, has been set equal to 1. Remember, so energy is energy measured at infinity per unit mass. Saying that epsilon is equal to 1 is saying that the energy of the particle at infinity is equal to its rest mass energy, and that's exactly what I'm setting out to do, because I'm releasing the particle with only rest mass energy, no kinetic energy, no potential energy, so that's what it all means. So we specialize then, we say that epsilon is equal to 1, and therefore R dot is equal to minus the square root of 2m over R. And that's a simple equation that could be integrated to get R as a function of proper time. Once you have that, you can express T as a function of proper time. And that's a way of obtaining the usual result that as the observer falls in toward the black hole, proper time stays well behaved, but Schwarzschild time, the T coordinate, goes out to infinity, and that, you know, tells you that there's something wrong with the coordinates as you approach the event horizon. We'll go through that story later on in the course. But for my purposes here, I'm essentially done. I don't need to go beyond that. So this is the expression for R dot, and the corresponding expression for T dot is just that it's equal to 1 over F when epsilon is equal to 1. So now we go back, and we can work out the redshift formula for this example. Leave that available. So this is the photon part. We figured out the emitter part over here. The receiver part, well, we know what it is. So let's see, I'm not going to change this expression over here, but I'm going to modify what's up here. So in this case, so if I go back and I ask what is the photon's energy as measured by the emitter, this is the only place where the calculation changes. Well, we just work it out in the usual way. So the measured energy is, well, the usual thing. And now we just need to work this out. So we have minus the metric times the momentum of the photon times the velocity vector of the emitter. And here we have to be a little bit more careful because this has TNR components. This also has TNR components, so now we need to be careful when we evaluate the double sum. So we start with TT, which gives me a factor of F for the metric. T prime for the photon is E over F. And the time component of the emitter's velocity, we worked it out, it's also 1 over F. And then we have the RR term, which is minus GRR, which is 1 over F. That's the metric coefficient. R prime, we worked it out, is just E. And UR, we worked it out over there, is minus the square root. All right. So we have cancellation here. We have a 1 over F that's common, a factor of E that's common. So what do we get? We get E over F. That multiplies 1 minus the square root. And the redshift formula is obtained when I take the ratio of E versus this. So I'll just rewrite what I got here. So that was a bad strategy because that blocks the view. But anyway. The redshift formula, so the photon's energy as measured by the receiver is exactly the same as what we calculated before, so that's the same E that we've used for the conserved energy for the photon. So now the final answer is that in this case, the ratio of received energy to emitted energy is F divided by 1 minus the square root of 2m over R. And here I... What do I mean by F? Well, the redshift that I'm calculating is going to be a function of where the emitter happens to be when the photon was emitted. So R is something that varies along the world line of the emitter. So I leave it as R because it's something that would depend on how far the emitter has proceeded toward the black hole. Thank you, because I was getting worried about the singularity that would emerge at the event horizon. Right, so R is just a variable, so the answer that you get would depend on what R was when the photon was emitted. So the longer you wait, the smaller R becomes. Okay, I can simplify this a little bit, because F I can factorize in this form. And I get this factor in the bottom. So in fact, I can write down the answer in a nice form involving 1 over 1 plus essentially what is the radial velocity of the observer. So it's a nice form for it. So that's the redshift formula to this situation. It's different from the one we worked out in the previous case. And it's different because the physics is very different. In the old situation, we had a purely gravitational redshift. We had two static observers. The only reason why there was a change in frequency or a change in energy is because the photon had to climb its way out of the gravitational well of the black hole. Here we've added an extra ingredient because the observer is falling in. So on top of the gravitational effect on the photon, there's also the recession velocity of the observer. So here we have a combination of gravitational plus Doppler shift in the frequency, and that changes the answer. And in fact, you can convince yourself that the redshift there is larger than the first one we worked out, because we're combining the effects they sort of multiply together, essentially.
Could you have done the Doppler and then just used your previous result? Would there be an easier way to just calculate the Doppler effect at that point?
It's an interesting question. So the question was, can you calculate the effect in two steps? First, you figure out the gravitational redshift, then you figure out the Doppler shift. If you're very careful, you can do it like that. But when you try to apply a Doppler shift formula that would have been derived, say, in special relativity, that would depend on a velocity parameter. And now you would have asked to ask which velocity parameter is appropriate for this calculation. Am I talking about velocity in coordinate time? Am I talking about velocity in proper time? You have to think very hard about how to make the proper substitution. And I prefer not to do that because I always get confused if I try. Whereas here, I don't get confused and I'm on safe grounds and I'm always trying to calculate things that in principle, quantities like that in principle can be measured. Velocity is very tricky. When you say what is the velocity of an object in curved space-time, it's an ambiguous question. You can try to pin it down if you say, what is the velocity as measured by me moving in this way in the curved space-time? You know, you can turn that question into a precise question, but unless you do that, you won't be able to really assign a meaning to something that you would like to call velocity. So the answer is yes, you can do it like that, but you have to be extra careful and think very carefully about what you're trying to do. One feature of this result, which is interesting, of course, is that the result goes to zero when the observer crosses the event horizon, right? So if you were here and looking at me falling down the black hole, and I was trying to report to you what I'm seeing by sending you laser pulses, what you would find is that it would become increasingly hard to measure my signal because, you know, my frequency, the frequency bandwidth of your detector would be limited, and at some point the frequency of my photon would go out of your receiver's band. So the frequency goes to zero, or the ratio of energies would go to zero as I'm crossing the event horizon. So that's a frequency statement which corresponds to the fact that, well, time distortions go to infinity as you approach the black hole. So there's an infinite difference between the proper time of an observer just above the horizon and time as measured in infinity. So that time distortion is packaged, featured in that equation right here. So there are lots of variations on that theme. For example, you could consider you could invert the roles, right? You could imagine that I'm still falling toward the black hole, but you're here and you're sending me news from PI, the PI newsletter. You just keep sending them to me every month. And you may ask, what's going to happen when I cross the event horizon? And I'll leave that for you as an exercise to work out. Suppose that instead of sending the photon that way, you send it this way, inward. Well, the calculation doesn't change all that much. You just reverse the sign of R prime in what we've done, so you can work it out really easy. And, well, I'll just ask you, so do you imagine that something very dramatic would happen as I'm crossing the event horizon? So just be honest, who would say, yes, something dramatic must happen? Who would say nothing dramatic will happen? And we have some undecided votes. If you work it out and if you think about it physically, in fact, nothing dramatic happens. I mean, the frequency shift might amount to a factor of two, something like that. The frequency, the received frequency by me compared to the frequency you sent in might be affected by a factor of some, maybe two or three, I forget. But really, there's no singularity, there's no dramatic event as I cross the event horizon. And the point is that if I look out, going into the black hole, I can still receive photons. I cannot send them, cannot send news for myself, but I can receive the news. And, if you work it out mathematically, you'll see that it is true. Anyway, so I like those kinds of problems. And, I hope you did too. Any questions? Yep. So, which? Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. You're not comparing an emitter with a receiver at infinity.
Yep.
So So presumably you can use these formulas twice at different distances R naught.
Right.
Or compare those results.
Yeah.
But my question is the following. Am I right in thinking that these results do depend on the Schwarzschild metric? That's to say, they'd be different if you had a different metric. Now, the Pan-Repke result doesn't depend on the metric, because it's just the effect of the accelerating coordinate system. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'll summarize the question for the people at McMaster. So the first part of the question had to do with, you know, what if I reconsidered this problem right here, and instead of placing the receiver at infinity, I placed it as, at a finite distance in the Schwarzschild metric, while the Pound-Rettke experiment, I think, is the other way around. I'm not sure if you emit from the ground and receive on the tower or the other way, it doesn't matter. Anyway, so if I were to do that, I would have to modify the end equation by a factor like this. So there would be two square root factors, one with R naught, the other one with R1, and more or less it would be the same story. So it was also pointed out that, well, you know, the derivation that I carried out here applies to the Schwarzschild metric because, you know, that's the metric I wrote down, and all the, you know, expressions that I got for the velocity vector really do depend on the metric. If I wanted to apply, you know, the results to a weak field situation, I could, you know, do something. I could simplify this by simplifying. This would be small under the square root. I could approximate the result by a Taylor expansion. So those are details that are not terribly important. But the point you really addressed is the fact that, well, it's known that the redshift of photons, the redshift experiments, are not sensitive to the details of the Einstein field equations. They are really a test of the equivalence principle. And that is true. So the point is that you can modify the metric in many different ways, so long as you satisfy the Einstein, so the equivalence principle, the redshift result is going to be the same. And essentially, I'll go out on a limb because I'm not completely sure this is true, but I think the way to see this would be to say, to recognize that the principle of equivalence is what fixes the TT component of the metric. So at least in weak field situations, like what would happen near the Earth or in the solar system, GTT, to a good approximation, is determined by the Newtonian potential, and the relationship between GTT and the Newtonian potential is completely dictated by the equivalence principle. The field equations don't enter at all in that connection. The field equations would enter in this. And well, this is a coordinate choice, but you could modify this component of the metric, leave this alone, you would still satisfy the equivalence principle, you would violate the Einstein field equations. And I hope I'm right when I say that the end result for the redshift would also be the same. I'm not completely sure because we seem to have involved GRR in the calculation, and maybe there's some subtleties that I'm not seeing, but I mean, But I think it's true that, you know, that while certainly the statement that the redshift result is insensitive to the Einstein field equations, that's a known, well-established fact. How it translates into what I've done here, I think there might be some subtleties, but nevertheless, what you said was true. Other questions? Okay, so I think what I'd like to do now is to move on and try to, we took a long time to do this. It's 4:45. Okay. Oh, we go till 5:30. Okay, good. I get confused. Okay, so what I wanted to do is to try to finish up chapter one of the notes. And what I'll do next is to just give you a few, quick refreshers on certain aspects of differential geometry that will come back later on, and for additional details, you should read the notes. I'll just, give you the highlights of all that. And we've momentarily lost McMaster. Okay, so we've seen a little bit of differential geometry, but now I want to just bring in some additional aspects of it so that we have a complete set of, you know, results that, will be useful later on. And the first thing I'd like to do is to talk a little bit about the metric determinant. So, well, in GR, of course, the metric is everything. The metric is, well, doing two things. First of all, it's the tool that we use to convert coordinate displacements into real physical displacements in space-time. So it has that sort of role as being something that really turns coordinate information, which could be arbitrary, into real physical information. But also, of course, it informs us about the curvature of space-time and all of these things, which are truly, you know, manifestations of the gravitational field. Well, just to say a bit more about that, I mean, the metric itself, I mean, to have a non-trivial metric doesn't guarantee that you're dealing with a non-trivial gravitational field. You could write, you know, the metric of flat space-time in a really weird coordinate system. The metric would look horribly complicated, and the motion in that metric in that coordinate system might look really, really weird, but you're still talking about straight lines in Minkowski space-time. It's just that you've disguised that in a weird coordinate system. So staring at a metric really doesn't tell you much. So the metric really plays a dual role. You have this sort of coordinate transcription business, and in order to really determine whether the metric corresponds to a true gravitational field, you have to decide yes or no, is there curvature associated with that metric? And for that, you need to calculate a Riemann tensor. If the Riemann tensor is non-zero, you know that you're dealing with a real gravitational field that creates curvature. If the Riemann tensor is zero, it's flat space, flat space-time. So I'll turn to the Riemann tensors in just a second. But of course, when you start calculating in GR, you always start with the metric. And, you know, we've done it before already. We've, you know, used the metric to lower indices. We've used the inverse metric to raise indices. And one thing that we encounter sometimes in differential geometry is this quantity right here, where G is the determinant of the matrix that represents the metric tensor. So G is the metric determinant, and it's the determinant of a matrix that you construct by just lining up all the components of the metric. And that turns out to be a quantity that occurs all over the place, and I just want to show you a couple of, well, remind you of a couple of examples. For example, so this is an extremely, you know, ubiquitous object, and one thing that that it's used for is to define invariant volume elements. If you want to do a volume integral in curved space-time, and here I'm talking about a four-dimensional volume integral, if you work in flat space-time and you're using Cartesian coordinates, you know that the volume element is going to be dt, dx, dy, dz. If you use different coordinates, or if you're in curved space-time, you have to turn that into something that's suited to your coordinate system. And the tool to do that, of course, if you're in flat space-time, would be to calculate the Jacobian of the coordinate transformation, and the Jacobian would be involved in the volume element. Well, all of that can be neatly formulated in terms of that quantity right here. And again, you can read the details in the notes, but the point is that if you take your coordinate volume element and you combine it with root minus g, you do form something which is an invariant measure of volume in four-dimensional space-time. So this is an invariant volume element. And the statement about invariance really means this. If you change coordinates, you're going to change d4x, you know, the dx0, dx1, dx2, dx3 thing, into something else that will involve the Jacobian. When you change coordinates, you change the metric, and therefore you change its determinant. Those changes will all package together in such a way that this combination is invariant, and this is a volume element in any coordinate system. The proof is in the notes. So that's the first example where you encounter that object. Another example is happens when you, well, if you were to calculate the contracted Christoffel symbols where you sum over the two indices here, this is something that could be expressed in terms of the metric determinant as follows. So you take root g, you differentiate it, you divide by root g, and you know, you can show that the result is equal to the contracted Christoffel symbol. And to prove this, again, the proof is in the notes. I don't need to work it through, but essentially that follows from, you know, if you change the metric, you're going to change the determinant. So when you differentiate the metric, you're going to. So this is something that depends on the metric derivatives, and the metric determinant. The derivatives of that are going to be related to the derivatives of the metric. That all follows from linear algebra, very, you know, very straightforward. But anyway, you can show that that you have that result coming out. And that turns out to be useful because there's some equation that involves that thing here that can be simplified or at least expressed in a convenient way if you make use of this identity. And one famous example is when you want to calculate the divergence of a vector field. And by divergence, I just mean taking its covariant derivative and summing over the two indices. That's called the divergence in space-time of a vector field. And this is something that can be neatly expressed as follows. And it's a neat formula that's actually useful for practical computations because that means that you can calculate the divergence of a vector field without having to work through the Christoffel symbols. And all you have to do is to combine a vector field with a metric determinant, you differentiate all of that, and you divide by g. And typically those operations, you know, take one or two lines and you're done. So it's a rather useful formula, and this is something that we'll encounter later on, and we'll make use of that. And the way this works out is simply the fact that, you know, when you expand this in terms of ordinary derivatives, you do run into that guy over here. You have a summation here the way that you have a summation there. So if you expand the covariant derivative, you end up with that term. You just combine them together in terms of one derivative acting on two separate things, and that's how you prove the result. There's another equation like this, and here I'll just double check that I'm not forgetting factors of two. Nope. There's something similar that happens if you take the divergence of an antisymmetric tensor field. And here it's probably worthwhile to actually work through the results. So suppose that B alpha beta is antisymmetric. And what that means, of course, is that if I change the ordering of the indices, I pick up a minus sign. So this is organized in a matrix. If you transpose the matrix, you pick up a minus sign. That's what it means to have an antisymmetric object. So suppose we have that. Then my claim is that if I wanted to calculate the divergence of this, by which I mean this, then this is also something which could be expressed in terms of root g in a convenient way. And the point is that for that to be true, it's got to be an antisymmetric tensor. If it were a symmetric tensor or something, you know, without symmetry, it just wouldn't work. That's also a useful formula that we'll probably encounter later on. So let's just see why that's true and why the antisymmetric condition is important. So let's work out the covariant derivative of a tensor that, for the moment, I'll assume doesn't have any symmetries. And before I do the summation, I'll just introduce, you know, a gamma index here because I find it's easier to do the calculation like this before doing the contraction. So let's work it out. So if we evaluate something like this, the first step is to calculate the partial derivative. And then because we have two indices, we need two Christoffel symbol terms. And they each come with a plus sign because we're dealing here with indices that are upstairs indices. So the first thing we do is we insert a gamma term that will carry one of those indices. It will also carry the derivative index. And then it will carry a dummy index. And the first term that we generate then is this. And then we add the second term, which will carry the second index. it will also carry the derivative index, another dummy index, and now we have that. Okay. Now I'm going to do the contraction, and I'm going to make gamma equal to beta, and I'm going to sum over the repeated index. So specializing, now we get the partial derivative term. Here we don't change that term. Let's see, except that gamma has become beta. And here we have beta d alpha mu. This is the thing that can be expressed as 1 over root g, derivative of root g. And here, well, we have different names for the dummy indices, but you can see that you can combine this partial derivative and this one into the combined expression I have over here. The issue has to do with this. Those two terms are equal to what we got over here. What do we do with that? That's where we need the antisymmetry property. Because if we didn't have any antisymmetry property, this term would just survive. But given that this has to be antisymmetric, noticing that this is symmetric, we have the product of a symmetric, quantity with a, symmetric quantity with an antisymmetric quantity, this vanishes. And that's why we need the condition, and it's only when we have that condition that we combine those two things, and there's no leftover term on the right-hand side here. All right? Okay, so those are, frequent examples where you see root g coming out, and I'm going to certainly use that later on in the course, so I just wanted to call attention to that. There's a fourth context, and in fact, it's actually related to this over here.
Go on. This yep. generalizes to antisymmetric tensors of all ranks, isn't it?
Why don't you work it out and tell us next time? I'm not sure.
I think I recall something similar for the space of all forms, and all forms are completely antisymmetric tensors.
Right. I think you're probably right. Yeah, so you could just keep on piling on the indices and you would still get the result. Yeah, and I think, well, yeah, I think it's simple because all the extra terms would be gamma terms times the n-index tensor, and they would all have that property of being symmetric times antisymmetric. So, yeah, so it would follow for exactly the same reason. Yeah, so thank you. That's a nice observation. Okay, there's one more thing I wanted to do about this, and in the process, I'll introduce a new tensor that's called the Levi-Civita tensor. And before I do that, I want to introduce the permutation symbol. And the permutation symbol is a four-index quantity, which is neutral as to whether the indices are up or down. So the reason for this notation, which is, which is very different from any of the other tensorial notations we've seen, is the fact that here I just didn't want to give the impression that the indices here were down or up or anyway. So this is a neutral notation, and this is the permutation symbol. Permutation. And it's defined in the following way. So essentially, it's going to be plus 1 if the set of indices here is going to be an even permutation of 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. 0, 1, 2, 3. And it's going to be minus 1 if it's odd. And it's going to be 0 if any of the four indices agree. So in three-dimensional vector calculus, we have the epsilon quantity that plays the same role. because here we are, you know, in that context, we have three dimensions. That permutation symbol has only three indices, and we also have all the possible permutations. Here, because we work in four dimensions, we have a permutation symbol that has four indices. And of course, if we were working in 26 dimensions, that thing would carry, you know, 26 indices. And well, for example, you know, if I write 0, 1, 2, 3, I get 1. If I permute 1 and 0, I get minus 1. If I permute, you know, 2 and 1, I get minus 1. And if I permute again, and I have 0, 1, 2, sorry, I wanted to do 2, 0, 1, 3, I get plus 1. So, you know, you just keep track of the number of permutations. If it's an even number, you're back to 1. If it's an odd number, you're at minus 1. And the other example is that, well, if any of the two indices coincide, then you get 0. So that's, well, that's something which is mildly useful. For example, you can define the determinant of a 4x4 matrix using this. So in the notes, I give you a little bit more context to that. But what I wanted to do is to define a tensor with the help of this quantity, because this is not a tensorial quantity. The notation is also supposed to remind you of that. But there's a related tensorial quantity that's called the Levi-Civita tensor. I'll move away from here. And the Levi-Civita tensor is a real tensor. It has four indices. It's completely antisymmetric, which means that you permute any two indices among the four and you get a minus sign. And it's equal to the permutation symbol apart from a factor of root g. So that's another place where root g occurs. So it's essentially the permutation symbol with an extra factor that makes sure that the quantity you've defined is actually properly tensorial. And by that, I mean that it will transform as a tensor transforms under coordinate transformations. I won't go through the details here. They're in the notes. But you can actually start from here and prove that if you construct, you know, if you do a coordinate transformation, the transform tensor will be, you know, this object here, this combination of things will actually transform properly under under coordinate transformation. And in fact, there's a really close relationship between this statement and the DV statement over there. For those of you who have studied forms, this is, well, another name for the volume 4 form on a four-dimensional manifold. And the root g here is the same root g that we've introduced here. So this is the sort of traditional elementary volume element. If you think in terms of four of forms, you will have seen that, you know, volume integration is something that is defined as an integration over forms. The dimensionality of the form corresponds to the dimensionality of your manifold. And the volume form in a curved space-time is defined in precisely that way. So it involves a factor of root g. And given that it's a four form, the form means that it's actually antisymmetric over all possible indices. Forms are tensors that are fully antisymmetric. Anyway, if you've never studied forms, don't worry. I won't use them in this course. But I just wanted to make the connection. So the key property here is that this is completely antisymmetric. And by that, I mean that if you change any two indices around, if you permute any pair of indices, you'll do it here. And you know, according to the definition, that will produce an extra minus sign. And you know, that's exactly what being antisymmetric means. For any permutation, you pick up a minus sign. If you do two permutations, well, the minus signs cancel out. And that's the statement about even permutations, you know, reproducing the same result. So this guarantees that the quantity is fully antisymmetric. And the square root of g over here, well, is the quantity that, you know, is the factor that tells you that we're actually talking about a volume form instead of some other, you know, form. in a four-dimensional manifold. And I'll make use of this later on in the course when we start talking about integration over surfaces, hypersurfaces. What we'll want to do is to induce from the four-dimensional manifold to the three-dimensional hypersurface a volume element. So we have a four-dimensional volume element from that we can specialize, that we can pull back onto the hypersurface, and the induced volume element will be defined in terms of that quantity right here, which is just in form language taking the volume 4 form and pulling it back to a three-dimensional manifold to generate a 3 form volume element. Don't worry about the language if you don't care to. Okay, so that's an extra ingredient that we'll need later on. And I think finally it's time to talk about curvature. I haven't talked about curvature, but clearly that's very important. So I think I'll just finish off with a reminder of a little refresher on the Riemann tensor. Well, there are lots of ways you can sort of introduce curvature in differential geometry. If your favorite point of view is that the connection is fundamental, then you define the curvature tensor directly in terms of the connection. And while essentially that's the point of view that I'll take here, but in my own thinking, I don't really care about making the connection more fundamental than the metric, so those distinctions are not terribly important to me. But one way of defining the curvature, the way that I actually do it in the notes, is just to notice that if you take covariant derivatives and you change the order, if you take two of them and you change the order, you don't get zero. So they're not the same. So partial differentiation is something that would commute under an exchange of operation. But for covariant differentiation, that doesn't happen. So one way of defining the Riemann tensor, and here I have to make sure that I don't mess up the indices, is to say that, well, if I take two covariant derivatives of a vector field, and then I do it in the opposite order, and I subtract the results, if I were dealing with partial derivatives, the result would be zero. But here I'm dealing with covariant derivatives, and when you work it all out and you expand all these covariant derivatives in terms of connections and things, lots of cancellations along the way, but the end result is not zero. And the end result, in fact, is the thing that tells you that you have curvature in your spacetime. And what you generate on the right-hand side is the Riemann tensor. And again, the indices sort of take care of themselves. You have one free index mu that has to appear here. You have two indices that come from the derivatives, and then you have, and then I messed it up, so as you see, there's one free index upstairs, there's a dummy index that appears second, and then you have the derivative indices that appear last, and here there's a factor involving the vector itself. So it's a pretty remarkable formula, because when you expand all of this, you generate second derivative terms that will cancel out. I mean, second partial derivative terms that will cancel out. You generate a whole slew of first derivative terms, terms involving first derivatives of A, and those all cancel out. And in the end, you are stuck with all the terms that are linear in A that don't involve derivatives. And what's left over, the coefficient that's left over, is the Riemann tensor, which can be expressed in terms of derivatives of the connection. It's a long expression. I won't write it out. It's in the notes. But schematically, you find that the Riemann tensor is essentially derivatives of gamma plus gamma squared terms. And there are minus signs here, because one thing that the Riemann tensor has to be is symmetric, anti-symmetric, under the exchange of alpha and beta, because obviously the left-hand side is antisymmetric, the right-hand side has to be antisymmetric as well. So that's one way of generating the Riemann tensor, and that's one way of defining it. Other ways can be, you know, can be invented, but you know, that's a nice way of doing it. And then you can generalize this. You can work out what would happen, for example, if instead of using a vector, you would use a dual vector and repeated the same exercise, or you could do it with a tensor. And for example, if you were to do it with a dual vector and repeated the same construction where you played a game of taking two covariant derivatives and then altering the order, well, also, in this case, you would generate a bunch of terms. The second derivative terms would cancel out. The first derivative terms would also cancel out by a minor miracle. And then what's left over would be proportional to P itself. And the result also would involve the same quantity that was generated here. And you would also generate the Riemann tensor that way. So as it just follows from the calculation here that you get a Riemann tensor with a dummy index in the first position. The free index now appears in the second position, the derivative indices here, and you have P multiplying the Riemann tensor through the dummy index. I never remember where to put the indices, so don't worry if you cannot either. If you read different books, you'll find that people like to place their indices differently. For example, in Wald's book, Wald likes to put this index in the final position. We're using the same conventions, but he likes to place his indices differently. It depends on, you know, who raised you and, you know, so on. And then, you know, if you do it with higher rank tensors, then, you can also work this all out in a systematic way. And if you're doing this with a two rank tensor, you would generate two Riemann tensor terms, one for each of the tensorial indices. So for an n-rank tensor, you would generate n terms involving Riemann on the right-hand side. And depending on whether the index is down or up, you get a minus sign or you don't. So you can find all the rules. I state all the rules in the notes. I never remember them, so I always have to look them up anyway, even though I've been doing this for 15, 20 years or so. There's nothing particularly mnemonic about this. Okay, so that's the definition of the Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor has very important properties, one is apparent here. So we do have the antisymmetry property of alpha and beta, but in fact, there's much more to it than that. So for example, if you take the Riemann tensor, and let's see, how do I write it here, mu nu? So if you, so we already identified the essential property that if you take the last two indices and you, sorry, if you take the last two indices and you switch them around, you pick up a minus sign because you have to have antisymmetry over the last two indices. So that's an obvious symmetry, but if you look a little bit deeper into this and you look very carefully at the expression for the Riemann tensor, you can actually identify more symmetries. And one of them has to do with what happens when you switch the first two indices. And it turns out that for those as well, you get antisymmetry. So here I was switching those two indices. Here I'm switching the first two indices. And we have antisymmetry with respect to each. And another property that also can be identified is what happens if you actually switch pairs of indices. So what you could do is to switch this pair for that pair. And I'll express it as R alpha beta mu nu being the same thing as R mu nu alpha beta. So lots of symmetries, and there's one more. There's a cyclic symmetry that tells us that if we take this with this order of indices, and then we add this with the cyclic permutation on the free and on the three last indices, and we keep going, we add this up, we get zero. So here we started out with the ordering alpha, beta, gamma, and now I cycle through gamma, alpha, beta, gamma, alpha, sum all of that, and for each choice of index, we get a zero result. those symmetries are really good because, you know, they really do simplify calculations. So sometimes you work out, you know, 10 different terms in an expression, and you notice that, you know, 8 of them are exactly the same one. They just differ in the position of the indices. So you just, you know, fix that. You put in all the appropriate minus signs, and you end up with something that may cancel out or may produce a factor of 8 or something like that. So there's something, I mean, you have to remember. So that is something I remember. I don't remember the, you know, the positioning of the indices here, but that you have to remember because it will save you a lot of time and effort when you do computations. Another good thing about this is that, well, when you count all the symmetry properties of the Riemann tensor, you end up with a very small number, well, much smaller number of independent components. So if you had a four-index tensor in a four-dimensional space-time and you had no symmetry properties, you would get 4 × 4 × 4 × 4 independent components. And I don't care to, you know, calculate that number. I don't want to know what it is. When you incorporate all the symmetries, you boil it down to 20. So in four dimensions, you only have 20 independent components of the Riemann tensor. If you're in three dimensions, it's smaller. If you're in two dimensions, you're down to 1. So in two dimensions, you have 1 independent component for the full Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor is, you know, as far as geometry is concerned, really a key quantity, as I said before. The Riemann tensor will tell you unambiguously whether you're dealing with curved space-time or a coordinate system that's just weird. So if you're given the metric and you calculate the Riemann tensor and you find a non-zero result, that guarantees that there's curvature in the space-time. So that's a theorem of differential geometry. A non-zero Riemann tensor means a curved space-time. And that means that we do have presence of real gravity, gravity that will produce tidal forces. The physical meaning of the Riemann tensor in general relativity is that it's what produces tidal forces as you move in a gravitational field. If you have a constant gravitational field that doesn't exert tidal forces, you don't have real gravity. You cannot distinguish that gravitational field from you know, a frame of reference that's accelerated. So if you want to have a real gravitational field, it has to exert tidal forces. You need the gravitational field to be inhomogeneous. You have to have gravity gradients in order to properly identify this with a true gravitational field. And the gravity gradients are encoded in the Riemann tensor. So it's a very, very important object. How to do that in practice, how to get the Riemann tensor from the metric? Well, in the old days, you would do it by hand, and you would come up with clever techniques to do it by hand. You start from the metric, you calculate the connection, you start differentiating the connection, you package it in that large collection of terms that you're generating here, and then you calculate for, you know, many hours, and you get zero. And then you try again, you get the next component, and it's also zero, and then you would keep on going like this and make, you know, thousands of mistakes along the way. And, you know, that was the life of a relativist in the old days. Now you download GR tensor, you enter the metric, and, you know, fractions of a second later, you have your full list of components of the Riemann tensor. So if you haven't done it by now, please take the time to look into tensor manipulation packages, because they will save you a lot of time when I assign you some homework assignments, which will happen next week. Well, let me say a couple of more things. And then we'll stop. And before I stop, I would like you to do me a favor for next week. Next week, I want to go into chapter 2. And I would like you to read the first 2 sections of chapter 2 before we get going. That sort of background material that I'll rely on, but I'll be moving quickly into chapter 2. So section 2.1 in chapter 2 is about energy conditions. So that's something that I'll, you know, that I'll say something about, but very briefly. And chapter 2, section 2.2 is sort of physical intuition about, or, you know, simple intuition about quantities that will introduce more formally later. So I would like you to read that for next week before we proceed into that material. So I wanted to say a few more things. So because we have the Riemann tensor, And now we're just a few steps away from formulating the field equations. So once you have the Riemann tensor, you have a very complete description of the curvature of your spacetime, and that in a four-dimensional manifold involves 20 different quantities. And generally it's useful to try to break it down into smaller pieces. And one way of doing this is to look at the Riemann tensor and take contractions. And there's a couple of extra quantities that are derived from the Riemann tensor that give you a simpler characterization of the curvature. And one is the Ricci tensor, which is defined to be a contraction of the Riemann tensor over the first and third indices. So this is the Ricci tensor. And the Ricci tensor doesn't contain as much information as the Riemann tensor because you have summed over some components, so you're losing part of the description here, but you know, it's still useful stuff that is preserved. And if you, you look at all the symmetry properties and you wonder what the consequences are here, what you would find is that, well, the Ricci tensor is actually a symmetric tensor. And that means that the number of components is restricted. So we started out with 20 components of the Riemann tensor. We boil it down to this quantity right here. If we had a random or a generic 4x4 tensor, it would contain 16 components. But the symmetry property means that all the off-diagonal components are equal, and that means that we're dealing with 10 independent components. So from the 20 original components of Riemann, we've extracted 10. Well, we can continue along this line. So we can define a scalar quantity that gives us a really, really coarse but very quick summary of the curvature content of the spacetime. And that is what happens when you take a contraction of the Ricci tensor. So you just sum over the two remaining indices in this way, or I can involve the metric and express it in this way, and that's the Ricci scalar. So that's one remaining component. So obviously you've gotten rid of a lot of information when you boil down the curvature all to this. And the reason for introducing these things mostly has to do with defining the Einstein tensor, which is the left-hand side of the Einstein field equations. So the last tensor that we'll need here in this connection is simply a combination of those two things. So we just define a new curvature tensor in terms of the old ones and the metric. This is also symmetric. And this is also something that carries 10 independent components. And of course, the reason for defining this and calling it the Einstein tensor is because, well, the Einstein field equations, so this is the Einstein tensor. And the reason, well, for this, as I keep saying, is that, well, the Einstein field equations are, you know, neatly expressed in terms of the Einstein tensor. The left-hand side is this curvature tensor that is essentially a large second-order differential operator acting on the metric, highly nonlinear in the metric. And the right-hand side of the field equations is the, you know, energy momentum tensor, which gives you the, you know, the description of the energy of the distribution of mass and energy in the space-time. And you know, a space-time will satisfy the Einstein field equations if its Einstein tensor can be related to the energy momentum tensor of the matter distribution in this way. So those are the Einstein field equations, and well, they do play an important role in general relativity. A metric will be said to be physically valid if it satisfies the field equations. If the metric doesn't satisfy the field equations, well, it's still a metric on a space-time manifold, but it doesn't, you know, satisfy any field equations. That would be like, you know, writing down an electric field that doesn't satisfy Maxwell's equations. You know, it's still a function in three-dimensional space, but it's not particularly meaningful or useful or physically relevant. So typically we tend to look for metrics that do satisfy the field equations. If you're not happy with Einstein's theory and you're thinking of inventing your own theory, you have a lot of freedom to do that because you can modify the field equations. You don't have to spoil the fact that gravity is described through curvature, you still have the apparatus of differential geometry and you still play with metrics, but you can certainly modify the field equations, for example, by adding, by incorporating other matter fields. For example, a well-known variant of the field equations would be where you introduce an additional scalar field in the description of gravity. You would have a scalar tensor theory. The tensor would be the metric, the scalar field would be the extra, would be the scalar field. And you would generate more complicated field equations that would determine the metric, but also the scalar field. And an example of this is Brandt-Stickey theory, but there's a whole class of tensor, scalar tensor theories. And those have been investigated in great detail. There's a framework available to test those theories using solar system measurements. So that, in fact, there's not a lot of freedom left in modifying the field equations. I mean, you can do it, but if you do it, you have to be sure that you don't violate any of the solar system constraints, and that turns out to be pretty hard to do. I mean, there are still other alternative theories that can be written down that satisfy all of the experimental bounds on things, but you have to be very, very, the theory space has become pretty narrow, and Einstein is still right there in the middle and satisfies all the experimental constraints. There's one thing I haven't mentioned, another symmetry of the Riemann tensor that turns out to be really, really important, and that's the Bianchi identity. And you can write down the Bianchi identity in terms of the full Riemann tensor, but you can also boil it down at the level of the Einstein tensor. And that's the last thing that I'll say. The Bianchi identity tells us that the divergence of the Einstein tensor is zero. And that's very important. That's a geometric identity that just comes out from the math. But together with the field equations, it has an important consequence, because if the divergence of G is zero, the divergence of T must be zero by the field equations. The divergence of T being zero is the curve space-time statement of energy momentum conservation. So one way of, so energy momentum conservation is obviously a very important fact, principle of physics. So the theory, Einstein really wanted to incorporate that in the theory. He had to struggle hard to find the appropriate left-hand side. And he had to, it took him, a couple of years to really reconcile himself with the fact that, anyway, there's a story there. But what he wanted to, what he really wanted to have in his theory would be a left-hand side that would have the prop. I'm not expressing myself clearly because it's getting late. But the point is that, if you want to have a theory that incorporates energy momentum conservation, having identified the right-hand side of the field equations as the energy momentum tensor of the matter distribution, knowing that this equation here is the curve space-time statement of energy momentum conservation, you have to be sure that the field equations are going to be compatible with this requirement. And this is possible if you make the left-hand side the Einstein tensor. Now, Einstein would actually turn this around, and he would say that energy momentum conservation follows from the field equations and the Bianchi identities. This is fundamental, this is derived, and everything that has to do with energy momentum conservation in physics is actually a consequence of the Einstein field equations. Well, you can take that point of view, which I like, but you don't have to stick to it. Energy momentum conservation would be true regardless, but there's a very, very deep and interesting connection between the field equations, differential geometry that gives you this identity, and something deep and physical which tells you that momentum and energy are conserved in physical processes. So it's all there. I think that's enough for today. So any questions about any of this? Yep. How much, sorry?
What kind of information? We lose 6 to 10 degrees of freedom.
Right. Okay, so the question has to do, so I've told you that when you construct, when you go from the Riemann tensor to the Ricci tensor, we're losing 10 components and we're preserving 10 components. So what are the 10 components? In fact, there's a very good description of what is being lost, and that's called the Weyl tensor. So I don't talk much about that in the notes, but there's a homework assignment at the back of chapter one that introduces the Weil tensor. And the Weil tensor is essentially what's left over after you've removed the Ricci tensor from the Riemann tensor. So one way of thinking about this is to say that the Riemann tensor is the Weil tensor plus the Ricci tensor. You have 10 components in the Weil tensor, 10 components in the Ricci tensor. The 10 components that are buried in the Ricci tensor can be fixed by the matter distribution. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the energy momentum tensor and the Einstein tensor, and there's a one-to-one correspondence between the Einstein tensor and the Ricci tensor. So the 10 components that are in the Ricci tensor are essentially directly related to the matter distribution. The 10 components that are in the Weil tensor are not directly related to the matter distribution. There's some loose connection that come from the field equations, but you can think of them as being roughly independent of the matter distribution. And in a sense, which is very loose, you can think of the Weil tensor as describing the purely gravitational degrees of freedom of the curvature tensor, and the Ricci tensor as describing the matter, the degrees of freedom. It's not very accurate, and you shouldn't quote me on that, but it's one way of thinking about this. So you break down Riemann into Weil plus Ricci. Ricci is matter, Weil is gravity, and Riemann is everything. That's a nice slogan. Other questions? McMaster? You're good? Okay, so that's enough for today, and I'll see you next week. And don't forget to read those early two sections of chapter two so we can get going